of your Monday edition of Justice and Drew is underway, and I am very excited to be looking across the table here at the beautiful man, the voice of the Vikings, Paul Allen. Good morning.
I don't think I've been called beautiful by a man since I called races in the Bay Area about 23 years ago.
Well, I find you very attractive.
Thank you.
I just wanted to, for the record.
Hi, Sammy.
I'm excited to have him this close to me this morning.
Hi, Sammy.
Makes me feel better about
Hello.
Me.
Giggling producer. Right back in the mix. How was winter for you guys?
It was winter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Spring settling in nicely, gentlemen.
Yeah, man. I went for a ride over the weekend.
I've been enjoying a ride.
A little bit of snow on the ground still.
What kind of a ride? Still,
bike ride.
Whoa, motorcycles.
No, pedal.
Oh, pedal.
Yeah.
Oh, see, I thought you were...
Streamers,
you were
basket.
Almost cool in his book.
I thought you were channeling your inner Jax Teller in Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah, no. Okay, I mean, seriously, can you picture me on a Harley?
Sam Sansevier was rooting for the truck, for those who followed that series. Oh, giggling producer, best ever. My world's a little rattled right now.
Yeah.
Simply because we begin 9 to noon down the hall on your home for Vikings football, FM 100.3, The Fan, with a typical weekend where you have a majority of people looking at the National Football League draft and not, A, seeing the forest for the trees, and B, uncomfortable because they don't recognize a fair amount of the names drafted by the Minnesota Vikings, which in the estimation of the loud ones in social media, that leads to a fail. You know, so I'm circling the wagons. I'm circling the emotional wagons heading into 9 to noon today, and we are ready for battle.
How much can you get into the intricacies when you've got new picks like this before you actually see them all working together, right? I mean, how much changes once you actually see how they work with one another as opposed to just their individual accomplishments?
Excellent question, because when I say not seeing the forest for the trees, the fan base, specifically with the sports talker down the hall, maybe to a certain extent a fair amount of your listeners now who live vicariously through Vikings football, the A topic is the Minnesota Vikings are off a 13-3 season. So the roster is pretty rich, it's pretty deep, and it's pretty much full of a lot of talented players. Secondly, free agency is part of the offseason. So when you make a move on a quarterback like Kirk Cousins, who is definitely, you know, depending on your taste, top 12-ish, top 15-ish quarterback in the NFL, there's an upgrade at the most difficult spot to find an upgrade or find stability. Thirdly, to your point, then what you do is you have the opportunity to kind of piece things together and put players in spots that you think either can help now or can help down the road. In the business, we call it the best player available approach. For instance, a few years ago, three drafts ago, the Minnesota Vikings desperately needed a wide receiver. So nearing the end of the first round, they drafted for need and took wide receiver Laquon Treadwell. And we're two seasons into the Treadwell experiment, and he has zero touchdowns. So I can't say it's a complete whiff, but it's not working the right way. That's why when you have to draft for something you need, it becomes more risky than being a good squad able to plug and play.
A lot of people expected the conventional wisdom was the Vikings would take an offensive lineman with their first pick in number 30 in the first round. Mm-hmm. I heard you specifically on your show last week say keep an eye out for this Mike Hughes kid.
Yeah,
and I heard you at the draft party. I was listening on Thursday night. And
I have all your albums too.
I heard you say,
including your greatest hits,
you know, a few picks ahead of the Vikings. You were breaking down Mike Hughes, and sure enough, that's who they took. What was your thought when that was the name announced?
Well, you know, by the time I do that draft show at U.S. Bank Stadium, day of the draft, I'm pretty squared away with the intel. So I like to lay out, when you're drafting from 30, there's a reason you have the 30th pick in the draft. It's because you just finished with a really good record.
Yeah.
So the teams with the crap records, they get to select allegedly the best players, but certainly the ones with the biggest names. That's not necessarily the case when you operate from the back of the first round. So, like, if the Vikings were picking in the top 10, I probably would have hit the crowd with three options. The Thursday night scenario involves six options. And it started with Chanhassen, Minnesota native Frank Ragnow, an offensive lineman from Arkansas. And I truly believe that is the player the Vikings coveted most at 30. He got selected at like 19 by the Detroit Lions. Okay, so now we cross him out. Next scenario via my work was Central Florida corner Mike Hughes. After that was attempt to trade out of the first round into the early part of the second round and maybe grab a fourth round pick that you lost in the Sam Bradford deal a couple of years ago. Then after that, there were a couple of offensive linemen that I think they would have taken. So with Hughes, him being the second option, to John's point, there were one of two ways to go. The public perception and perhaps the reality is we need an offensive lineman. So do we draft for need at 30 and take somebody who we do not have graded as highly as this corner Mike Hughes? Mm-hmm. The answer was no. With Hughes, you'll get a very speedy guy who I believe will play immediately this year. He is as good a punt returner as I've seen in quite some time. You know, that could play into some familiar names currently on the roster. And overall, he was the best player that they had ranked on their draft board. So they took him, and I have no problem with it. Now, you come back to pick 62 in the second round. Given the state of the Minnesota Vikings offensive line, which is good but can get better, now the desperation factor for an offensive lineman heightens a little bit. But again, you're at 62. So instead of making some foolish, grandiose move to move way up and get somebody you want and have to give up currency to get that individual, they waited and they took an offensive lineman from Pitt named Brian O'Neill.
Who do you expect to be, if you had to guess right now, who's going to be starting between Brian O'Neill or Mike Remmers? Or neither.
Remmers will start. I'm not sure if it will be guard or tackle. O'Neill is incredibly athletic. He's very, very fast for an offensive lineman. This is a cat who did act, believe it or not, from an offensive lineman standpoint at Pitt. He did things offensively involving carrying the ball, throwing the ball, and stuff like that. So there are some gimmicks you probably can do with him. He's a converted tight end. I can't marry myself to saying he will start in 2018. Now, there's a guard the Vikings drafted in round 6 from Appalachian State. I think he has an opportunity to win a starting job right out of the gate. So, again, that's Appalachian State. And nobody follows it. Nobody's heard of the guy.
I went there.
Really?
Yeah.
So you know everything about this guy. You have all of our intel. You and Daniel Jeremiah.
I'll do a hit on your show later today.
I'd love that. because, you know, doing I emceed something called the Minnesota Football Honors last night at U.S. Bank Stadium, honoring high school, college, and pro football players. So in chatting with it's interesting to follow public reaction because they're not savvy or familiar with the players the Vikings drafted, and then sit down with the general manager and the head coach and chat about these players and feel how glowing and excited they are about what they got.
Looking at, you know, taking into account Kirk Cousins and what took place in the draft, are you optimistic, sad, or indifferent?
In what way?
Just in regards to the outlook of the team going into next year, based off of all the changes that have taken place.
Well, we're coming off 13-3. Schedule came up incredibly tough. Now, I'm not one to look at the schedule and in April and start guessing what the wins and losses are going to look like.
Right.
I will do it nearing the end of August, early September, because people want me to do it. But it's such a week to week situation. Where the LA Rams last year, when they came to US Bank Stadium, they were the cat's ass of the NFL. They were outscoring everybody. The running back was going to be the MVP. The quarterback was rejuvenated, and they didn't score a point for the final 55 minutes of the game. So you have to analyze it in this league on a week to week basis. Overall, from a Viking standpoint, I am absolutely infatuated with the team. Now, they lost a couple of guys in the offseason in running back Jerick McKinnon and defensive tackle Shamar Stephen, where, honestly, I wish both those guys were still on the team. McKinnon got $8 million a year to be the featured running back for the San Francisco 49ers. Dalvin Cook is the featured running back here, so I completely understand that. So there are some situations that need to be filled, but I'm not going to run through the litany of names on this roster it's an incredibly good roster and should again be an incredibly good team with a quarterback who is better than Case Keenum. And I was a big time Case Keenum fan and have a lot of respect for what he did for the Vikings last year. Kirk Cousins is a more talented quarterback than Case Keenum. Thus, it should be deemed an upgrade.
And just from just my perspective on this, when it comes to Cousins, his PR campaign and what he's done since he got the gig, I've been kind of impressed with. I mean, not knowing, again, you know, so I'm on the periphery when it comes to, I like what I've seen from him just in the public spotlight and him embracing of the team. And I'm sure that's pretty typical of when a quarterback goes to a new team.
Yeah.
But, and again, this is just periphery perception. Well, I'm already a fan without knowing much about this guy, just based off of what I've seen in the comments that he's made in public.
It depends on what you're looking for. The intel I had on him from Washington and subsequently in chatting with him four times here is spirituality means a lot to Kirk, mm-hmm. and it's real.
Yeah.
It's not...
I appreciated that.
It's not, you know, post-game, God helped us win this game. You know, he doesn't go overboard with it to make it... give a perception
sure.
that he is something he's not. It's just very deeply rooted within him. He's a very kind individual. He's also, I don't want to say on the shy side, but he's on the quiet side. He's thrown for more than 4,000 yards three consecutive years, and he has a really good arm with good mobility. And with Adam Thielen and Stephon Diggs and Kyle Rudolph, maybe this new tight end the Vikings drafted, Conklin, you know, he should be able to do some damage in the passing game.
Let's talk about the later rounds in the draft. We talked about the first overall pick, Mike Hughes, Brian O'Neill, the offensive lineman. Going down the line, we got a defensive end, a tight end, a kicker. Did that take you by surprise at all that they drafted a kicker in the fifth round?
Well, it did, but it shouldn't have. Now,
they've done this before.
Yeah, Kai Forbath has been mostly reliable for this team, but I kind of thought Kai was etched in to be the kicker next year. I didn't put a lot of time into special teams intel into this draft, so that did catch me off guard. The fact that they moved up to get him in the fifth round, he's an incredibly accomplished kicker from Auburn. So I, you know, if we're laying out prop bets here, I have to make him favored to be the kicker in 2018 over Forbath.
I better be. They wasted, I'm not wasted, but they used a very valuable draft pick on the guy. So I would hope they did that with the intent of him.
He's got to be favored.
Being a contributor.
Very strong leg.
I saw a lot of commentary online that a lot of people's favorite pick of the entire draft was that tight end from Central Michigan, Tyler Conklin.
Mm-hmm.
What's your thoughts on him?
Well, I'm not super familiar with him or how he plays. And when I get out to rookie camp, I'll have more opinions off that. The philosophy of the new offensive coordinator, John DeFilippo, he was quarterback's coach in Philadelphia, and the way they utilize their tight ends, and also the way Kirk Cousins likes to throw to his tight ends from his days in Washington, it was apparent the Vikings were going to draft a pass-catching tight end middle of the draft. So they took Conklin, and that's what he is. He is a pass-catching tight end. This is not a tight end, from what I understand, that you handcuff to an offensive lineman, and you're like, we're going to play bully ball and run behind you. So it's another receiving option for the quarterback, and that's, from what I understand, exactly what the new offensive coordinator wanted. Now, there also is college free agency, and the Vikings, these are players who were not drafted,
right.
And then they hit a pool, and then their agents, they go team by team by team, given the interest level, and they negotiate deals to determine which team they will go to. The Vikings spent a lot of money in college free agency last year, ended up with some players who either made the practice squad or the team, like defensive end Tashaun Bauer. We have an undrafted guy this year who's incredibly intriguing. His name is Holton Hill. He's a cornerback who is supremely talented. He basically got kicked off the Texas Longhorns program nearing the end of the 2018 season. And I'm not exactly sure what went into it, but I think insubordination would probably be a fair way to put it. From what I understand, they paid as big a price for a college free agent for this individual as they've ever paid. Maybe biggest in the history of the organization. They're very intrigued by him. I think he has a great chance to make the team, and I think he has a great chance to play if he squared away with like Holton Hill, the guy, as opposed to Holton Hill, the player. So so he's undrafted, and I think it's very compelling that he's here. They also moved on Maple Grove, Minnesota wide receiver Jake Winicky. Now, Jake played at Maple Grove High School, then South Dakota State University. An incredibly accomplished receiver. Not the fastest thing in the world, but he catches everything. And think about that. You grow up in Maple Grove, you don't get the University of Minnesota, despite lofty high school equity, is not interested in you. You go to South Dakota State University, you become at least a four-time All-America. You don't get drafted, and then you end up as a college free agent with your childhood favorite team, the Minnesota Vikings.
That's fantastic.
I think it's an awesome story.
Yeah.
So I hope he at least makes the practice squad.
I do too. Any last question before we let you go here? Anything outside of the Vikings draft that really stood out to you? Any big surprises? You know, what's your A topic for non-Vikings draft related news?
Well, these are opinions, so they're not right or wrong, and we watch them play out over the years to see who's right and why. Cleveland had the first and fourth pick, and they took two guys that I would not have taken.
Yeah.
I would have taken UCLA quarterback Josh Rosen first. That's my for my taste. Fourth, they took a corner named Denzel Ward from Ohio State. I think they left a transcendent defensive end in Bradley Chubb. They left him on the board. Likewise for Notre Dame offensive lineman Quentin Nelson. I think they missed on a couple of guys. So they had a big opportunity, and I'm sure these guys will be okay.
And they pulled a Cleveland.
But well, we'll see, because Cleveland, with all the picks it had, has the opportunity to go from the dregs to respectability in a hurry. I think the Chicago Bears did pretty well in the draft. I like the Iowa offensive lineman they got. I like the Memphis wide receiver they got a lot. Green Bay drafted for secondary and did it early with a Louisville corner Jair Alexander and Iowa corner Josh Jackson in the second round. So they, you know, they're looking to shore up what has been a shoddy pass defense. And the NFC North should be quite good next year.
They drafted, I think all four teams drafted pretty well in the NFC North.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah. I mean, because after once you get past rounds 1, 2, and 3, that's where the scouts who spend countless hours, while we're doing the regular season, there are college scouts all over the country going to college games, meeting with players, meeting with coaches, and amassing intel that helps for what transpired last week.
Yeah.
So now you just have to rely on your staff being upper echelon, and hopefully you get players who help.
Paul Allen, 9 to noon.
Good seeing you guys.
Thank you, sir.
100.3.
Bye, Sam.
Take
Bye.
Care. Thanks for coming in, man.
651-989-5855. Coming up, really good expose out of the Star Tribune. We'll give you some points from it. Meth cuts lethal path through Minnesota, highlighting that while we've got this opioid epidemic here in Minnesota, we have this meth problem that continues to get bigger and bigger, and we'll give you some of the numbers coming up next. Realize that I only thought that it was Avengers Infinity War. I didn't realize it was 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Yeah,
I knew it was long, but not that long.
Usually, I really have a distaste for movies that are much longer than 2 hours.
This is true,
and it's something that I'll actually go check to see how long a movie is before I'll go see it. And it has kept me away from seeing some movies. What was the one? It was a Wolf of Wall Street that was like 3 hours and 1 minute.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That was that long?
I think I might be thinking of a different movie, but there was one movie that cracked that 3 hour mark. It was like 2:59. It was right around 3 hours, and I avoided that for the longest time. But I don't even care with these Marvel movies. I don't even look. I don't care. And none of them feel as long as they are.
Yeah, yeah. The runtime on Wolf of Wall Street is 3 hours.
Yeah.
Wow.
I wanted to see that in theaters until I saw it was 3 hours long. And I was like, you know what? No, not going to do it.
That's a good percentage of your day.
Yeah. That's the only time that's the only time I have an issue, you know, is like, I really want to go see this again. But boy, that's going to chew up a lot of time. But given how long that movie is and the fact that it's making all the money that it is even more astonishing. And the funny thing about this movie, especially for those that have seen it, is that you want to watch more.
Yeah.
Just keep going, please.
I didn't want to leave the theater.
Please don't end.
Like, don't, yeah. Let's start the next one now.
Let's go now.
I need to know.
We have one year.
Where we're going from here.
We have one year.
Well, maybe. I have a feeling that... I have a feeling that this storyline will be advanced in a non-Avengers movie between now and then.
But not to the extent that's going to pacify everybody.
Probably.
As we dance around this. Yeah. And let's get to other stories, you know. Let's do some meth. Let's do that. Covers of it. Talk about meth. Not actually do meth.
Talk
about a very...
horrible, awful thing.
Invasive on-air bit.
Right. Star Tribune... a story by Stephen Montemayor, and look, this is actually a really, really good expose. It's a very, very long piece, incredibly detailed, titled Meth Cuts Lethal Path Through Minnesota, highlighting this problem. And it lays out a lot of personal stories of individuals that have been involved in this. And for example, the story that it leads with here, somewhere along his path to a better life, William DeRue Ramirez found himself hauling carloads of meth up to Minnesota for one of the same drug cartels that wrought horror back in his home country of Mexico.
I have a problem with the way this is framed from the get-go.
Mm.
Because it's almost written in a way that they want to make this guy out to be a sympathetic figure.
I agree with that.
You know, somewhere along his path to a better life, he found himself. No, he made choices.
Yeah. Yeah.
He chose to do this. He saw an opportunity to enrich himself. The job paid well, promising as much as $20,000 for each delivery. He made a conscious decision to go this route, and that's how he wanted to... That was his path to a better life in the U.S., was to deliver meth at 20 grand a pop.
He made the trip more than 15 times when authorities pulled him over in Oklahoma in January and found 152 pounds of crystalline shards packed inside the Toyota Camry he had borrowed from a friend in Phoenix. It was one of the biggest meth loads ever stopped on its way to Minnesota.
Yeah. And then the next sentence is, the next day, the clean-cut 26-year-old led federal agents to three of his buyers in the Twin Cities. I mean, this guy was a drug trafficker.
Yeah.
Stop trying to portray him as, you know, some victim of circumstance.
The arrests of Ramirez and his associates are the latest proof that meth, after largely fading from public view a decade ago, has come roaring back. It's more potent, more plentiful, and cheaper than ever. And this time around, the Mexican drug cartels that control it have handpicked Minnesota as the regional hub for their entire upper Midwest meth trade.
Yay, us. Couldn't get Amazon,
woo.
So...
But we got meth.
And
it's almost as good as the Amazon headquarters.
To the to your point, Drew, and I agree. This individual is a really, really good example of, and I'm gonna make the correlation here. We were talking about the caravan of individuals coming up from Central America, and a lot of the individuals that were involved in that caravan were also just people from Mexico as well that were deciding to come into the country illegally. But it tells you sort of the problem that you get into with individuals, and this is why, to me, immigration is so important. And I'll try to keep this little analysis short. Reason being is that when you've made the decision to come into the country illegally, you're starting off on a negative. Mm-hmm. And when you're starting off in that negative, knowing that you're already perpetually in a state of illegality, sometimes that goes and provides the opportunity, not always, but sometimes the opportunity to continue to make poor decisions because you're already in a position where if you get in trouble, you know that the other things you're going to do that you're doing, you know, are just going to be on top of the one thing you're already doing wrong. This guy here was in a loop. He was in a loop of illegal activity and did it so many times and was getting paid so handsomely for it that he felt that he was not going to get caught. Right? He just felt like, you know, hey, I've done this now 15 times. I've driven this 15 times already. I'll be fine. Well, nope. You know, you got very accustomed to your illegal behavior, and you got busted for it.
This guy made about $300,000. I mean, if the numbers are right, if you just count the 15 times, if it's 20 grand per delivery, I made $300,000.
You know,
I don't think he was a victim of circumstance. I think he was very opportunistic.
And you get into state and federal investigators in Minnesota seized 1,500 pounds of meth last year, four times the total retrieved 5 years ago. Some of that meth was bound for major dealers in Green Bay from Green Bay to Fargo. Plenty was left over to wreak havoc here. The number of Minnesotans treated for meth addiction doubled in the past decade to almost 14,000 last year. More than those treated for addiction to heroin and other opioids combined. And look, not all of this can be solved by better border security. A lot of it could be mitigated with better border security, right? And yet we can't have a relevant conversation about border security and the wall because Trump.
Right. Right. When a Republican starts talking about this drug trafficking being a real problem and human trafficking and sex trafficking being a real problem along our border, and we try to make the case that providing more border security is truly the most compassionate thing you can do for a large number of people, you're going to create a lot fewer victims by having border security, victims here in the United States of people that are peddling meth and people that are bringing the drugs in, victims of sex trafficking, victims of human trafficking. We get accused of dog whistling and being racist and xenophobic.
Yep. You can't dare say the wall. No, because Trump says the wall.
Yeah.
And you just that's just not allowed.
Yeah.
The number of overdose deaths peaked during the first meth crisis at 18 in 2006, soared to 140. In 2016. That's according to the most recent data compiled by the Minnesota Department of Health. At least 80 people have faced federal meth distribution charges in the past 2 years. Kent Bailey, a former senior U.S. Drug Enforcement with the former U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, he was with them prior, said Minneapolis has become a major market. He now leads a federally funded counter-narcotics program in the metro. You can sit there and keep your head in the freaking sand, but the sheer volume of drugs being seized indicates otherwise. Many of those caught supplying Minnesota's meth have had direct ties to major internationally known drug cartels in southern Mexico.
Yeah.
It's frightening. One couple managed a Brooklyn Center stash house where agents found 140 pounds of meth, much of it bound for Wisconsin. Another man fled the country as investigators closed in on a crystal candy shop believed to double as a stop-off for meth in California. And last summer, agents arrested a hair salon owner as she burst out of her Lake Street shop gripping a duffel bag loaded with meth. It's just the stories that are compiled in this article are just insane. Others, even the historic Ramirez seizure, have done little to slow the flood of meth.
One little side tangent that I just want to point out about this story. There's an interesting little part in the story that demonstrates how ineffective our current policies towards drug abuse and drug problems are. When you go the prohibition route and when you go the route of banning legal products or making it harder to get legal products because they might be used, it talks about how Minnesota, later Congress, clamped down on the sale of products like nasal decongestants that contain the chemicals used to make meth. Politicians do this sort of thing and they pat themselves on the back and they go, "Good, we're tackling the problem. It's now harder for you to get nasal decongestants because other people might make meth with them." What's the outcome of that, though? What is the result of that? Drug cartels discovered a more efficient and cost-effective way to crank out a more potent version of the drug.
Oh, great.
Now, that's not to say that you just turn a blind eye and you don't do anything, but rather than go the prohibition, incarceration, and banning route of trying to fight these sort of things, government would be much better served by going a more treatment-oriented route.
Right.
Work on fixing the problem by getting people off of meth and not ever having them start it. But they go these prohibition routes because it's easy and it's politically expedient and it's a very lazy. And what happens is you get these workarounds and you end up, it's happened with marijuana. It's happened with cocaine. It's happened with meth. All the black market, in their workarounds, they end up finding more efficient ways to create more potent versions of these drugs.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the voters buy into it, lockstep. You know, we have to do something. Oh, that's a really good thing that my elected official is doing and making sure, because you know we can always make other nasal decongestants, but this is just horrible for drugs.
I got to jump through hoops to get things, you know, to get cough syrup or nasal decongestants because of the black market on meth. You know, all that's done is make my life more difficult, made the pharmacy's life more difficult. It hasn't done a lick.
Right.
To actually tackle the problem. When you talk about, you know, when we talk about how you want to handle any sort of drug crisis or drug abuse problem, always go the treatment route. The treatment route is more cost effective and it is better long term.
Barely a month after Ramirez was stopped, law enforcement happened upon another 82 pounds of the drug hidden in a pickup, allegedly driven by a member of the same cell thought to be managed by the notorious Sinaloa cartel. Kenneth Solick, assistant special agent in charge of DEA's Minneapolis office, said meth is just our biggest problem. And meth's resurgence has occurred largely in the shadow of the opioid epidemic that has claimed the lives of thousands. And just two more quick things on this. The overarching message, according to Greg Booker, he became the acting U.S. attorney last year, embarked on a statewide tour to meet with law enforcement officials to discuss the biggest challenges, said the overarching message is that Minnesota is dealing with two simultaneous drug epidemics, opioids and methamphetamines. And state law enforcement officials want more manpower to help keep up with the rising tide of drug investigations. Manpower. They want more. They need you know, like police officers and officials to go and deal with it.
Yeah.
You know,
good luck getting that done in St. Paul and Minneapolis.
Yeah, we won't have time to get to it today, but you know, in somewhat related news, Minneapolis is moving towards a 100% sustainability with their renewable electricity plan.
Oh, good. Cool.
That's great.
That's going to fix nothing.
We will we'll shred that appropriately on tomorrow's show. Coming up, though, we do want to double back to Bernie Sanders. We have an update on his Everybody Gets a Job plan. Reason.com did a write-up on it. Says that Bernie Sanders does have a job plan, and it's called socialism. In the meantime, apparently he is encouraging many other individuals who are running campaigns on straight-up communist platforms.
Woohoo!
Yay!
Your
Monday edition of Justice and Drew, and we want to hear from you. 651-989-5855 is the phone number. Or use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter. Tomorrow on the show, we will be joined by Senate Majority Leader Paul Gyzelka and from Fox News, Pete Hegseth, for their regular Tuesday visits.
Looking forward to that.
A lot of fun.
Reason.com picked up on Bernie Sanders and his jobs plan, saying it's called socialism. Can't get work and trim hedges for the government. It's a really great piece. A couple of highlights from it. Hey there, displaced factory worker looking for work. Bernie Sanders has a job for you. How would you like to make $15 an hour cleaning up
for the rest of your life
park trails for your municipal government?
And never achieve anything beyond that.
What? You say that sounds like something an employee of the city's parks department already does or is supposed to do? What about repainting school playgrounds? Oh, the unionized school district gave you a stern look. Hang on, he'll get back to you. Because he doesn't have a plan. His plan is to just invent a bunch of new government jobs and pay them $15 an hour with benefits. Ta-da! Problem solved.
Yeah. We fixed everything.
Just make up gigs. No, really, the article goes on to say. That's kind of the plan. According to the Washington Post, which reported the proposal last week, Sanders' office doesn't have a cost estimate or any idea of how it's going to be funded. Post policy writer Jeff Stein turned to a study by a pact of left-leaning economists for Levy Economics Institute of Bard College, who seem to think only good things will happen in the creation of millions of government-funded jobs and hardly any bad things.
I know how they're going to fund it. So they'll create these jobs and they'll hire you for these made up jobs at $15 an hour. Then they're going to tax you $14.50 of that per hour to go pay for the. It's going to be self funding.
Okay.
They're going to tax you all of what you earn to keep paying you what you're earning.
When they talk about paying for it with tax revenue, they ask the question, if everybody goes to work for the government, where would their revenue come from? Oh, I'm sure they'll figure something out. So maybe it's your idea. So what sort of government work is there that would provide $15 an hour plus benefits to millions of unemployed Americans? The Levy Economics Institute study provided some examples. Would you like to hear some of them?
No.
How these guaranteed jobs might play out at the local level. Here's one.
Oh, no.
A local artist collective employs painters, actors, musicians, and stagehands to run year-round productions for the community.
That nobody's going to go see.
They organize school outreach programs, run summer camps, and offer free art, music, literary classes for disadvantaged special needs youths. They collaborate with local schools and offering art enrichment programs.
Wow.
So we're just
talk about a worthless pit to throw money into,
right?
And that's not to disparage artists and musicians, you know. But you know that's going to become the most entitled group of people, you know. Once you set up a program like that where they're getting government money to run these programs, they're going to put on the most commercially non-productive and non-successful shows that you could possibly imagine. But, you know, they're entitled to that money. They got to keep it coming in.
The federal government could pay a bunch. They could pay a bunch of individuals. They could be government-run podcasters. Oh, wait. I'm sorry. They already do that. You might think to yourself, by the way, these are the kinds of jobs that certain people with certain types of interests have been begging the government to fund for years. Indeed, much of the examples in the Levy Institute study seem like descriptions of programs that certain types of local government-connected people with very particular ideas would like to see the government doing. The report openly uses the Works Progress Administration of the New Deal as a model to support it. Oh, and perhaps you're wondering, is there even any widespread demand for these kinds of jobs that aren't being already filled? That may sound like some sort of reference to marketplace capitalism, but that's not the point. The point is jobs. As the study declares, it separates the offer of employment from profitability of employment. Projects are created to serve community needs rather than prioritizing whether the projects are deemed profitable in the narrow sense.
That's not profit should never profit should never factor into why you should do something. You should just do it because somebody thinks you should.
Right.
Yeah.
They go on to say, of course, can people be fired? We talked about this. According to Sanders' plan, it calls for something sinisterly called the Division of Progress Investigation to handle discipline. The study treats these jobs as though they can be created and eliminated as the economy demands. But trends in government worker employment scream more. There will be tremendous pressure and inertia to keep these jobs going once they are filled. It's not a surprise to see Sanders embrace such an incomprehensible, economically illiterate employment program and declining to consider the consequences. When he ran for president, he repeatedly called for free college education based on programs from other countries without seeming to have any grasp on how those education systems work. How long, you know, is this a tee up? Like, how long until this ends up, you know, becoming something that's more popular or more more widely accepted? Because I don't see this going anywhere.
I don't see it going anywhere yet. But, you know, Bernie Sanders is kind of like that canary in the coal mine for the Democratic Party. You know, he throws out the crazy ideas. And if it dies, then the party moves away from it. But, you know, he gained a lot of traction and a lot of support in the primary. So there is a large swath of the left, of the Democratic base, that thinks Bernie Sanders is the direction the party needs to go. And you mentioned it earlier, you're seeing a lot more candidates sort of openly embrace the concepts of socialism, the word socialism, and running on that platform based on the success Bernie Sanders had. So I would not be surprised to see this become more of a mainstream line of thinking within the Democratic Party. It's incredibly dangerous, and it's going to be incredibly expensive, and it's going to do so much damage to the people that end up getting these government jobs. That's going to be their peak.
Oh yeah.
Career-wise, once they get sucked into this system, they're never getting out.
No.
They're never getting out. They're going to peak at $15 an hour doing menial government work because it's easy and they can never be fired.
By the way, doesn't it fly? Because you're right. When you're the sort of that testing ground, sort of the Bernie Sanders trial balloons.
Yeah.
I remember the free college was getting a lot of coverage and way more coverage than it deserved at the time when he proposed free college for everybody. But doesn't the free college for everybody kind of fly in the face to the $15 an hour?
Because, well, that's going to be their life. They're going to work. They're going to work $15 an hour jobs, and they're going to go to college forever.
But why go to college if you already make it? If you already got a job making $15 an hour, why bother?
Because it's cool.
Why bother with life at that point in time? I'm good. Thank you.
651-989-5855. We were talking about the Star Tribune piece on the growing meth crisis. We got a call from Todd from Anoka County. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Good.
Thanks for calling in.
So I was listening to you guys talking about this, and you talked about, fixing the problem and with the drug enforcement agencies. And as I'm reminded, I had firsthand experience with this treatment. That's not always the best answer, just because most treatments are 30-day spin cycles. They get them in there, they put them through it, they're clean for 30 days. Sometimes they end up in the aftercare programs, and then they go right back out. And it's very difficult for the counties to keep monitoring these guys, or people.
Right.
Rather. And so, again, most people in their situation don't have insurance to cover it. Out-of-pocket expenses is enormous, and it really becomes the biggest challenge to break the cycle of addiction.
Okay. So, what do you think? It sounds like you're running counter to the suggestions on the show. What do you think is the way to the best way to sort of fundamentally address the issue?
We're going to have to look at better programs, long-term programs, for these individuals that are desperately seeking pain relief in their life, because that's why they're using
the treatment. You got to improve. I get what you're saying, that the current methods of treatment aren't necessarily working, but what also doesn't work is just incarceration. You know, incarcerate people that are actually out there doing the real crimes. You know, you're talking about the traffickers, the dealers, you know, the people that are pushing these drugs, manufacturing these drugs, putting them on the streets. Those people, yes, incarceration by all means. But the addicts, the people that are really struggling, the people that, you know, for one reason or another have found themselves, and maybe the only crimes that they've ever committed are, you know, associated to their addiction. Those are the people that incarceration doesn't do anything for. Those are the people that you need to focus on long-term treatment to get them off of these, get them away from that addiction.
Right. And I can agree with that.
Yeah.
The habitual user has been affected in their mind so badly. It affects their reasoning center first and foremost, and they no longer are rationally capable of making good choices anymore.
Yeah.
The problem...
I appreciate your call, Todd. I don't understand the motivation behind punishing the addict. The addict needs treatment. The addict needs help in no longer becoming an addict. You know, when you just throw them in jail, when you just incarcerate them, with a 99% certainty, you're only making their life worse. You're only making the problem worse.
Well, and the other facet to the conversation, and I think the other thing to look at, right, and I agreeing with what you were saying, Drew, is that the story that we cover from the Star Tribune clearly laid out that we are becoming here in Minnesota a hub for these, for meth to come to us. It's been profitable for the drug cartels to bring the product up here. So it's clear that we have a big issue with the influx and the availability, the easy availability of meth in the region. Mm-hmm. So while you're right, focus on the treatment of the individuals, we also need to do better at stopping the drugs from getting here yes. to Minnesota in the first place,
exactly.
coming all the way up from that place way, way, way down south.
Jay, calling from southern Minnesota, not referring to southern Minnesota.
No.
Yeah.
I was talking about a place where we want to put the wall up.
We don't think you're responsible for the meth, Jay.
Yeah, it's that Iowa. Record. Blame Iowa.
Blame Iowa. Yeah, right. Stop it in Iowa.
I guess I don't follow the logic. You know, I'm going to throw the gun control issue out here. If they think their way to solve assaults in schools is to make assault rifles illegal, then we shouldn't have a meth problem because meth is already illegal. So I don't see, you know, why the gun control people think passing a law to ban certain weapons is going to stop any of the school shootings when obviously you can't legally buy meth. So, you know, there must not be a meth problem here.
Right. Yeah. Right. Clearly, you know, making it illegal hasn't had the impact. It just goes to show the sort of knee jerk, lazy government politician response to a problem by just throwing out the word ban. You're going to ban this and ban that. That doesn't change behavior. That never changes behavior. You make it harder to get nasal decongestants. You make it harder to get cough suppressant or cough syrup and all of these things because some people might be abusing them. Fine. You've made it harder for me, the law-abiding citizen who's not going to abuse them. You've made it harder for me to get a hold of those products and use them responsibly. And all you've done is driven that behavior one step lower underground where chances are they're going to find, as the drug cartels did, more efficient ways and the product is going to end up being more potent.
And we're seeing some embracing of new ideas when it comes to treating individuals who are drug addicts. And I know there was a story, I want to say it was out of Boston. I know it was in the Pacific. I mean, excuse me, in the Northeast. But where law enforcement was willing to go and help individuals who were addicts rather than going and taking them in and locking them up, they were actually going and giving them rides to clinics to go and seek treatment. Mm-hmm. So they've actually started to approach an idea of how can we as law enforcement do a better job of dealing one-on-one with these individuals who are addicts rather than just going and locking them up for possessing these illegal narcotics.
Let's go to Jason in Minneapolis. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning. I guess the one thing that I think is being missed in this discussion about just treating them as addicts, as people with a problem, is every addict out there has committed or broken many laws on their path to becoming an addict.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true.
Well, of course it is. The first time you smoke a joint, it's illegal. The first time you take, heroin or something or cocaine, it's illegal. Meth is illegal. So every first time those people are breaking the law, and then every time after that, plus they support a industry out there that, you know, people have drug houses on their block, and that ruins the neighborhood and things like that. So how is that ever dealt with?
Problem is, you don't fix any of those problems by going after the people who are, you know, who are on that route, right? You arrest somebody for smoking a joint. What have you accomplished?
Well, I don't know. Maybe first-time offenses should be greater.
Because our justice system has done a really wonderful job of actually rehabilitating people.
Well, I don't think the justice system has dissuaded anybody from using.
No, look, there's always going to be a segment of society. I appreciate your call. We are short on time, though. There's always going to be a segment of society that's going to look to alter their consciousness in one way or another.
Sure.
You know, and there's a lot of people that do those things and don't ever become addicts or burdens on society in any way. They go on and live fine lives. I don't think that the answer is trying to go after those low level first time offenders and punish them more harshly. That's not really going
to
do anything.
Well, we need to make sure that law enforcement has the flexibility to go and deal with the issue as they seem fit. You know, we going a zero tolerance route on a lot of these issues and a lot of these circumstances is not going to yield the results in helping individuals. There are some cases, people that have broken the law, that need to be held accountable. Others where people just simply need help.
Yeah. Eric and Ramsey, you got 30 seconds. Quick.
The surefire way to end all drug use is to put public service announcements everywhere telling people that do drugs that, hey, you're a dirtbag. You don't get any help. You go to jail. But you're a dirtbag even for doing it.
All right. You run for office on that.
Like, I want to assume that he was trying to
be sure. He said it was surefire.
Yeah.
So.
Surefire not to help.
Let's try it. Let's do that.
Hey, good job, everybody, except for that caller.
Yeah, except for that guy.
Good show, everybody. We'll get back tomorrow.
Yeah, that guy's trying to get later.
6 to 9. Paul Gazelka, Pete Hegseth on the show tomorrow. Have a wonderful day, everybody. To give me nothing. Open up the door.
I'll get him myself. I'm Chris Addison. Here's a look.